Okay, so I've called this talk Pieces of the Jigsaw, History Through the John Johnson Collection of Printed Ephemera. So I just wanted to examine the term ephemera, or as it's properly pronounced, ephemera, though nobody in the ephemera world calls it that. It's a cumbersome term, rather academic, for something so ordinary, something which is normally thrown away. So what is ephemera, or rather, what are they, because it is plural? Johnson used the term, the terms the ephemera of printing and printed ephemera in his correspondence well before the term was established by the publication in 1962 of John Lewis's book Printed Ephemera, which I have here. He was perhaps the first in Britain to define ephemera, albeit somewhat negatively, something they have suffered from ever since. He described ephemera as everything which would ordinarily go into the waste paper basket after use, everything printed which is not actually a book, and everything which a museum or library would not ordinarily accept as a gift. And bear this last point in mind. You could say that ephemera is just an umbrella term for a variety of mainly single sheet material, a catch-all for the ballads, advertisements, scraps, rose souvenirs, trade cards, and Christmas cards, Bellman's verses, and railway timetables represented here. And also for tickets, menus, bookmarkers, postcards, posters, election cards, and flyers. The list is extensive. The Encyclopedia of Ephemera bears testament to this. The Centre for Ephemera Studies at the University of Reading's brand new thesaurus also has a very, very extensive and intricate definitions of all the terms that come under the umbrella of ephemera. But the point about ephemera is that they transcend these genres and become pieces in the jigsaw of social and printing history. Their charm and their importance is that they are chance survivals, which give us often unexpected insights into the daily lives of our predecessors. But it is dangerous to infer too much from a single piece of ephemera. Their effect is cumulative. The more restaurant menus we have, for example, the more conclusions we can draw about what relatively affluent people like to eat in a certain time frame. That's why an important part of my job is to refer people to other relevant collections in institutions or online. And of course, ephemera are only part of the jigsaw, alongside the more established and respected forms of books, manuscripts, maps, and music. It is remarkable, of course, that these fragile items have survived. Their subsequent journey to the Bodleian as one of its special collections and onto our screen is more amazing still, not to mention the inclusion of ephemera in numerous Bodleian exhibitions, including Marks of Genius. I would like to begin with a consideration of the founder, John de Molins Johnson, as a pioneer in the collection of ephemera. Although not born in Oxford, John Johnson spent most of his time here. He was educated at Magdalen College School and then read Greats, followed by Arabic, at Exeter College, becoming a papyrologist after a brief spell in the Egyptian civil service. It was those excavations of papyri in Egypt which inspired him to ask himself what we were doing to preserve our immediate paper heritage. He wrote, "Often I used to look over those dark and crumbling sites and wonder what could be done to treat the background of our own English civilization with the same minute care with which we scholars were treating the ancient." Certainly he had illustrious predecessors in the collection of ephemera, among them John Selden, whose collection of ballads was continued by Samuel Pepys. Pepys coined the term vulgaria for these single sheets. However, early collectors typically specialised in one or two specific areas of what are now considered ephemera, as many, many collectors still do today. Johnson's vision was much broader. Johnson himself paid tribute to six great men of his own time, or just before, who saw the truth that the waste, the ephemera of today, are the evidential data of tomorrow. Call them collectors or whatever you like. They were Robert Proctor, an incunabulist on the staff of the British Museum, but whose ephemera came to the Bodleian, the Reverend W.D. McRae, who worked at the Bodleian, E.W.B. Nicholson, Bodley's librarian, George Potter, Jacoby, founder of the Chiswick Press, and Harry Peach, who founded the Dryad Handicrafts firm in Leicester. However, Johnson recognised that in the breadth and depth of his own collection, he had created something new. I think I can say that the width of these collections as they stand has no other counterpart in the world. Collected on these on this wide area, they render us open to the banter of the world. That he intended it to be all-embracing is underlined by his challenge. As you can see, I challenge any to suggest any subject in which we can record no evidence at all. Had he not been unfit for military service when the First World War broke out, Johnson might never have formed the collection. Returning to Oxford, he secured wartime employment at the Oxford University Press as Assistant Secretary to the Delegates of the Press. After the war, he remained there, becoming printer to the university between 1925 and 46. The press was an ideal environment to form his Museum of Common Printed Things, or the Sanctuary of Printing, as it was often called. Officially, it was named the Constance Mead Memorial Collection of Ephemeral Printing, after the benefactress who, as well as passing on to him ephemera collected by her great-grandfather, Bishop Percy of Dromore, himself an ephemerist, to use an anachronistic term, enabled him to furnish the former Bibles printer's office at the press, which you can see here, to house his growing collection. It is important and humbling to remember that this was Johnson's hobby. Johnson collected retrospectively, except in certain areas. For example, developing technologies such as the telephone, the Marconigram, and private presses where he knew the printers. He felt strongly that ephemera should survive by chance rather than design. 1939 was his cut-off date. We have virtually no ephemera from the Second World War, and 1940s, 50s, or most of the 60s. Johnson's curation of his own collection was innovative. He cannily divorced the organisation of his collection from library technique. File cards were the state of the art at the time and clearly impossible. After all, you'd need at least one, if not three or four, cards for each item. In terms of physical storage, Johnson established different colours for each of his main headings. His perfectly ordinary file boxes were bound by apprentices at the press, and they also tooled leather labels for them. You can see them here, courtesy of later colour images of the collection in the new library. Out of this structure grew 680 subject headings, which you will find online. In protecting his collection from the light and from greasy fingers, Johnson was again innovative. At a time when many collectors, including Bellacy Landau, who was establishing a parallel collection at the New York Historical Society, were using scrapbooks, Johnson used good quality paper offcuts from the press to mount his collection. Only his method of hinging has caused us problems, as it is too brittle to enable the verso or last page of any document to be folded flat for reading, and most important, recently for digitisation. So what are these main themes? I'll read them because this is being podcast, so advertisements, arts and architecture, artists, authors, book trade and publishing history, educational, entertainment, form or genre, pastimes, political, religious, social and economic history, printing processes, prints, private presses, sport, topographical, transport and travel and holidays. The 680 subject headings you can see arranged both alphabetically and under these main themes online. Johnson's maxim was let the material sort itself. There is no one sorting principle you can apply. Theatre programmes are arranged by venue, advertisements by product, education by place, transport by mode of transport and so on. The type of index Johnson and his assistant Lillian Thrussell established merely indicated the subjects represented in each section and how they were arranged. We produce the same sort of indexes now, albeit in PDF form. So where did the material come from? Johnson's position at the press meant that he had many contacts in the bookselling world who sent him bundles of ephemera and a network of conoscenti. He avoided advertising too much what he was doing, fearful that the market would catch up with ephemera, then deemed of little monetary value. He was right. It has. Two articles about the collection were published in the typographical journal Signature. However, in 1926, the Hebdomadal Council of the University rejected, after 10 years' indecision, the F.A. Bellamy collection of postage stamps and postal history. Johnson rescued what he could of this with his own money. Even more significantly, when Johnson was at OUP collecting ephemera, the Bodleian was actively disposing of them. the eliminations. A new clause of the statute enables the curators to eliminate from the library material of no literary or artistic value or of an ephemeral nature which it is not in the interests of the library to include in the general catalogue or preserve on the shelves. These eliminated ephemeral were passed to John Johnson by the first keeper of printed books, Strickland Gibson, and came back with the acquisition of the collection in 1968. There was no private property in the collection. Early in its formation, it became a university collection. When Johnson died, unexpectedly in 1956, the press retained the collection for a further 12 years, recalling Johnson's assistant Lillian Thrussell to look after it. She accompanied it to the Bodleian. Amazingly, it had only taken 30 years for the Bodleian to do a complete bulk fuss. In 1971, the Bodleian mounted an exhibition of 259 items or groups of items to a slightly bemused public, as you can see from the reviews here. Ironically, the library was then in the vanguard of what is now known as ephemera studies. The catalogue of the exhibition is still the standard work on the formation of the collection, and it's online. So using the collection, we do of course have real readers here in the Western Library looking at real documents for which they do need an A-ticket, but they don't necessarily need to be scholars. People use the collection for a variety of reasons, but the focus of this talk is inevitably on the resources that I can show you here. It's important to realise that only a small fraction of the material is catalogued and digitised, about 100,000 items of about 1.5 million. Since those original indexes of John Johnson, the curation of the collection has certainly evolved in interesting, unforeseen and unforeseeable ways. In terms of physical storage, the collection is not just as Johnson left it. Books have been weeded from boxes and added to the separate sequence of Johnson books. Sections have been resorted and re-indexed. Housing has been improved with the addition of Mellanex and acid-free folders so that we can create an acid-free environment without having to dispense of Johnson's original bound boxes. This has inevitably meant that the collection has expanded. Items have been taken off their mounts when digitised, for the reason I explained earlier, and remounted with Japanese paper. Pre-1960 material has been added to Johnson's original boxes in small quantities, and a decision was taken to collect contemporary ephemera when the collection came to the library in 1968. We simply cannot afford not to do so. We collect intensively for major events such as the Queen's Jubilee, the Olympics, elections, and so on, but also generally. And I've put on the table some ephemera that I picked up yesterday morning. This is not the time to discuss the pros and cons of such contemporary collecting, but it is an interesting problem. By far the most far-reaching change has been the advent of computers, which have revolutionised what we can do with ephemera. We have been fortunate to undertake many projects with staff in quite a lot of cases, and in the case of the ProQuest project, there were 10 of us. I'm very fortunate to have been in post before and after the computer age, or during, I should say. Computers enable us to make connections through cataloguing, make the collection known outside the library, create virtual collections through digitisation. The arrangement in Johnson's original boxes, however logical, is always only one of the ways in which ephemera could be arranged. And through OCR, optical character recognition, search the text of the items themselves, which adds a whole new layer of access. Ephemera are ideal candidates for digitisation, of course. Often the whole document is a single sheet, so you can see the whole thing on the screen. Many ephemera were designed to attract. Many ephemera were innovative with new printing processes, such as rainbow printing or compound plate printing. The key to all this is cataloguing or metadata creation beyond the scope of the indexes we looked at earlier. Cataloguing is not normally designed to make people sit up and look interested, and indeed I will spare you much detail. Suffice it to say that ephemera have traditionally been the bête noire of cataloguers. That's partly why they have languished so long in libraries. They are difficult. They just don't behave decently like books. There is rarely a title worthy of the name, rarely an author, rarely a date, and rarely an imprint. Cataloguing them can take an awfully long time, too, for a scrap of paper. Our records are long, often even longer than this. While ways of cataloguing books, maps and music and manuscripts electronically were quickly established, there is still no standard for ephemera. given that I am one of the very few ephemera librarians in the world, and that ephemera are held not only in libraries, but in museums, archives, and local history collections, and each type of institution has evolved a different method of cataloguing, this is scarcely surprising. We have evolved our own system, readily exportable into other formats for projects, for joint projects, and I'm very grateful to my colleagues David Halliwell for setting this up, maintaining and migrating it, and Thaddeus Lipinski for creating the catalogue webpage complete with images. The tagged format, which is very detailed and aims to create as many cross-references as possible, is online. We aim to catalogue as much detail as we possibly can to make as many connections as we can between items, and we digitise when project funding allows. Scarily, however, a lot of scholars seem to believe that we've catalogued and digitised everything overnight. So I have to remind everyone that we have only catalogued 100,000 of 1.5 million. With the exception of two projects, Toyota and Ballads, all our catalogue records are on our own site. Searching and browsing is fairly basic, with the records in both display and bibliographic forms. There is much to explore through our own website, and the leaflet I've put at the front will tell you how to find the various resources, which I'm really going to whiz through. You can find motor cars and other forms of transport through the Toyota project, the Bodleian's first digital project, political cartoons and trades and professions prints, trade cards and our Nations of Shopkeepers exhibition, which was the first one Bodleian exhibition to go online, board games, writing blanks or schoolboys' pieces, and 18th century entertainment. But our whizziest project was in partnership with ProQuest, called somewhat confusingly the John Johnson Collection, an Archive of Printed Ephemera. It focuses on just five areas of the collection: advertising, 19th century entertainment, crime, murders and executions, popular prints and book trades. Everything else we have catalogued or digitised falls outside its scope and needs to be accessed through our own site. You can access this project, as Wilma said, free of charge in the UK through higher education, further education, schools and public libraries, but you can't just sit at home and type the URL and hope to gain access. It uses exactly the same metadata as on our own website, but with much more functionality than our own online catalogue. So this is a quick tour. You can browse and search. You can view the context of the items, so you can actually see how they are arranged in the boxes, as if you were going through the boxes themselves. You can search within the text of documents with hit highlighting. You can filter the results, so here's a search for the benefit of, but filtered by method of production on Silk. Or here, a name search for Ellen Terry, but filtered by advertisement. There are tailored separate search screens for each of the five areas, so you can find out who we have in terms of the material in the collection, who was transported for sheep stealing, for example. The iconographic content of the material is indexed using Sasori. And there's a lightbox facility which enables you to save the images you particularly like. These can be emailed to people, so I do most of my inquiries this way. And if you click on a thumbnail, as long as you're inside the project, it will take you back to the relevant item. Other nice features are zoom, on-screen measurement in both dimensions, and rotation. So what is the importance to scholars of this material which escaped the waste paper basket? It is invidious to pick on just a few items, especially in isolation, as the strength of ephemera for research is the cumulative story they tell, in the cross-references as much as in the minutiae. However, I have tried to pick examples which cast interesting sidelights on history. Here we have posters, or playbill in the case of the left, so the two are really often indistinguishable, showing a variety of entertainments you would expect in a single evening. These posters of 1842 and 1884, respectively, show the effectiveness of display type, printed in black and red or blue and orange, to orientate the reader towards the main themes. But the details of the spectacles of the Vauxhall Gardens poster in smaller type are, of course, fascinating to us. the performers, prices, refreshments, and the availability of boats. Right at the bottom, we learn that permission has been given to the proprietors of the state carriage which belonged to the Emperor Napoleon and which was taken on the field of Waterloo to be exhibited within a handsome tent erected on the stage of the Ballet Theatre. On the right, from the poster from the Canterbury Theatre of Varieties in 1884, there's again an array of entertainments which include In the Trenches, which is an episode from the Crimean War. That took place 30 years earlier. So it shows that although ephemera are of their time, they are also interesting in showing us how long events stayed in the public consciousness. We have a good collection of murders and executions broadsides with some of the most grisly images in the collection. These broadsides carried illustrations of the crime, the criminal, prison cells, court scenes, or hangings. All those are represented in this slide. These broadsides are formulaic, typically including verses and last dying words, almost invariably expressing penitential and pious sentiments. On the left, the murder of Jane Jones by Daniel Good in 1842. In the centre, Joseph Connor, executed in 1845 for the murder of Mary Brothers. And on the right, a multiple hanging in 1816, which exemplifies the poor quality of these quickly produced execution broadsides. The printer clearly didn't have a block available for three hangings, so he just added two of the criminals to the edge of the sheet. These were the gutter press of the time. They were sold at the scene. I'm particularly fascinated by trade cards, and especially tradesmen's lists, such as this one, which give us a wealth of information about the nature and provenance of merchandise. This beautifully engraved example for John Lyde, dating from 1795, shows us the breadth of produce sold by an oilman. Many of these goods remain luxurious and exotic today. Pineapples were, of course, much prized at that time. Barberries were an acid red berry. Botargos were a relish made of the roe of the mullet or tunny. The last reference to these in the Oxford English Dictionary is dated 1852. There is much more to be done with ephemera in terms of the etymology or even the first use of words. The problem is that ephemera are often not dated. Because they are of their time, there was no need to date them. The same is frustratingly true of ephemera today. I haven't looked, but I imagine that those items that I picked up yesterday rarely have the year. In this particular case, the verso has been used as a bill, and so we do have a date, May 1795. And these are, in case you couldn't read it on screen, a transcription from our catalogue of the items that were sold in that bill. And of course, with the manuscript content on the verso, you often get additional items. Also dated by a bill on the verso is this beautifully engraved trades card for Spilsbury of York Street, the bill being made out in 1759 to Lady Betty, or Elizabeth Harcourt, daughter of Simon Harcourt, 1st Earl Harcourt of Stanton Harcourt, so tying in neatly with our manuscript collections. Benjamin Morgan's letterpress trade card gives details about the trade in ass's milk, as well as showing a typical shop sign of the time, and dates from about 1793. From the trade card for Edward and Mary Hutton, we have evidence not only of a woman in trade with her husband, rather than, as was quite common, a widow carrying on a business, but also of a son who is intentionally damaging their business by claiming to be in partnership with his father. We also have evidence of the combination of chimney sweeping with emptying necessaries, and a change of address, although frustratingly, again, without a date. It's around 1850. The last trade card for Castle, Marlborough, is fascinating in that it relates to sending cheese by the equivalent of mail order, with the claim that these cheeses will bear a voyage to the West or East Indies. The BRA stamp reveals another source of Johnson's ephemera, the British Records Association. Johnson formed his collection with a dual purpose, to document printing history and social history. Ephemera are very important in terms of printing history, as often experimental techniques are used to create them. The Assyria bill here of 1879 is printed by Rainbow Printing. The Drury Lane silk playbill of the 15th of May 1800, was reputedly dropped by George III when a second attempt was made on his life that very day. The Hazard Lottery Bill is printed by the anti-forgery Congreve compound plate printing process, where two finely engraved plates are inked separately and brought together to be printed in one impression. This enables the fine white lines to run between the two colours, almost impossible to achieve by registering the plates in the normal way for printing in two impressions. This embossed item was printed by Whiting and Branston and dates from the last year of lotteries, 1826, before their recent revival, of course. The collection is full of wonderful examples of chromolithography. The label for the Royal Jubilee Stationery Cabinet, 1887, is just one, printed by Charles Goodall and Son, who were famed for playing cards and Christmas cards. And finally, a wood engraving with ornamental type. Laura is surprisingly difficult to date, anything really from 1863 to 1890, though I would favour an earlier date rather than a later one. Design history pervades the collection. I've chosen just two examples from the 1890s, one French, designed by Eugène Grasset in 1892, and the other Dudley Hardy's famous Gaiety Girl of 1894. This slide shows the names of colours which were used in the 1890s. I think that's quite an interesting sidelight on art colours and printing colours, and in this case, colours of dyes and distemper. The John Johnson collection is by no means a local history collection, but it is very strong in provincial ephemera. I've chosen some examples from Oxford to make the point. Family historians, whose ancestors are likely to be represented in the collection, performers, tradespeople, artists and so on, can use our names index fairly easily. Optical character recognition software has transformed access to the textual contents of letterpress ephemera, previously underexplored. So I searched for the word pantechnicon, and that brings us to its origins as a bazaar with arcades used to store furniture. The collection includes not only a description of this new phenomenon, but the regulations for the storage of wine in its cellars, and an advertisement for Seth Smith's patent metallic chimney linings, which was the sixth and last item on the document we first saw. I just put that at the top there. The Pantechnicon apparently had 150 of these chimney linings, and an aside typical of ephemera tells us that the metallic chimney lining will supersede the odious practice of sweeping chimneys by climbing boys. Prices and illustrations tell us much more than you could possibly hope to find in the contemporary press or in secondary literature. Clearly, a Chinese pantechnicon was added a few years later at the same address, and then we have the predecessor of the modern meaning of the term with the horse-drawn furniture removal cart, with apologies for the poor slide in that case. So this brings us to genius, for which there are 1,206 results in a keyword search of the ProQuest project. It is rare for textual ephemera to be used in Bodleian exhibitions. Usually they provide some welcome colour or images, but this element was not needed in Stephen Hebron's very visually attractive displays. Genius is a difficult concept too in terms of ephemera, as it is usually somewhat retrospective. Stephen has focused instead on the misuse of the term genius by unscrupulous advertisers and promoters. To remind you of some of the items he selected, he states in the caption, "It may be asked what the ephemera of our lives, as Johnson called it, has to do with genius, which is exceptional and rare, and stands apart from the ordinary concerns of daily life. Ever since the word acquired this meaning, however, salespeople have had no scruples about using it for their own ends and have cheerfully called upon it when promoting something. It is a sign of the extent to which the word has woven its way into the language that it may be used to describe the highest reaches of creative achievement, what is set to stand the test of time, and equally find a place in the more ephemeral worlds of fashion and the market supporting the hyperbole of the salesperson and the critic." Here's some more of the uses. It's And I can't leave the subject of the uses to which ephemera are put without mentioning ephemera studies and material culture, because it has become a study field in its own right. As I mentioned, there's a Centre for Ephemera Studies in Reading, an Encyclopaedia of Ephemera, and thriving ephemera societies in Britain, the USA, France, where it's called Le Vieux Papier, Australia, New Zealand and Denmark. So what is currently happening in the collection? Our work is a microcosm of the library, really. Acquisitions, cataloguing, inquiries, outreach. I'm basically on my own, but have a wonderful team of volunteers, some of whom you can see in this slide, with some visitors from Sweden, and some of whom are present in this room. They all have their own projects and are a huge help. Our office is now in the Western Library, that's it, at the top left. Readers look at the material in the rare books and manuscripts reading room. A major part of the work at the moment, having moved the collection out of the new library 4 years ago, is preparing for its return to the Western Library. Some of my volunteers are sorting the backlog of pre-1960 ephemera at the moment. Another volunteer, present here, processes the library's book jackets, and that includes all the dependent libraries. Others are cataloguing. We now have a new web interface. So one of them is cataloguing book plates, also here present, and others are cataloguing postcards and a new collection of games which we acquired called the Ballam Collection. Modern ephemera is also sorted by a volunteer. We acquire antiquarian ephemera by purchase and donation, including whole collections. New collections recently acquired are the Ballam Collection of Games, the John Fraser Collection of Propaganda Postcards, and most recently a large collection of trade cards and bill headings. And as Wilma said, there's rarely an exhibition where the collection is not represented. We've spoken of the Genius Exhibition. Jess Clark's forthcoming beauty display is going to be a vaccination display and a major exhibition on history and entertainment, and they will all feature the collection. We even made it into one Arthurian legend through a theatre programme. An advantage of the Western Library is the seminar rooms, where curators can introduce ephemera as a resource to new generations of scholars. We work closely with the English and History of Art faculty, and I have History of Art students on curatorial placement each year. And finally, these days, it is easy and fashionable to promote collections through social media. I have limited time for these, but plenty of enthusiasm. So we have a John Johnson Collection blog about the collection, an ephemera resources blog about other collections, which is tagged, of course. I tweet and retweet, more often retweet, and those feed through to a Delicious page. I did eventually establish a Facebook page, and I use Instagram to showcase our backlog finds. So this is the end of my tale, if you will excuse the pun. But what next? Oh, for a crystal ball. As far as I'm concerned personally, I want to look backwards as well as forwards and document the history of the collection, as well as getting it in as good state as possible, physically and in terms of online finding aids. We ephemerists have all travelled a long way, and we have all contributed in our various ways to making it unthinkable to exclude ephemera from the historic record for generations of future scholars. It is undeniable that new technologies are enabling ephemera to leap out of dusty corners of institutions onto our screens. And as a result, the usefulness of ephemera to inform historical research is growing. Ephemera have taken their rightful place here as elsewhere, as evidential data alongside books, manuscripts, maps and music. Not bad when you consider that they were being eliminated in the 1930s. John Johnson, who once wrote that he dreamt that his collection would form a miniature typographic wing of the Bodleian, was, in my humble opinion, not only a pioneer but a visionary. I hope that he would be pleased with this evolution and, above all, the use which scholars are making of his collection. Thank you.